The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Tea for the Tillemans. Yuri wins Leicester City their first FA Cup. Fans there to cheer his wonder strike as the ball stays ball. Stunning saves from Kasper Schmeichel and Wes Morgan's real-life anxiety dream. Not a great weekend for Chelsea as the following day their women are blown away in an extraordinary first half by Barcelona in Gothenburg in the Champions League final. Goals change games, so conceding in the first minute and letting in four before half-time really does change things. And fair play to Alison Becker, who manages to bring us the moment of the weekend in injury time at the Hawthorn. Look, there's a 6'3" bloke in tights wandering into our penalty area. We don't need to mark him. All that, plus the European title races, a dancing Leonard Slutsky, your questions, your emails, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, hello.
Morning, how are you doing?
I am very well, thank you for asking. Hello, Floyd Lloyd. I'm not that well, clearly Wilson. Am I? It's an early mistake. It's like Chelsea women in the Champions League final. It's just booting it into my own net after 6 seconds. Flo Lloyd Hughes, how are you?
I'm all right. I'm having a stretch, having a coffee, getting ready for the week.
Okay. I mean, you're at work right now, Flo.
So I need to switch on.
Yeah, you need to switch on, much like the Chelsea women's team should have done. Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hi, I've already done my stretches ahead of the start of this podcast, so I'm ready to go.
I'm sceptical that you have a morning stretching routine, Barry.
Well, just getting out of bed sort of activates various muscles. It's taking increasingly long to get from bed to floor in an upright position.
Just rolling out. It's an age you just roll out of bed and lie on the floor. And if you happen to be on your back like a turtle, you just can't get up. And that's your day, isn't it? Anyway, let's start with the FA Cup final then. Chelsea 0, Leicester City 1. First time Leicester City won the FA Cup in their history. 21,000 fans there to see it. And Wilson, it wasn't necessarily a great game, but it had great moments.
Yeah, I think it was a great final rather than a great game. But for an hour, not a lot happened. But the last half hour was great. You know, the goal was brilliant. Those two great saves from Kasper Schmeichel, Wes Morgan's almost calamitous 10-minute cameo. I mean, can you imagine? I know it's not really the big story, but kind of Brendan Rodgers in this moment of great sentimentality chucks on a 37-year-old who hasn't played for 6 months. And then he scores an own goal in the last minute to lose the whole thing. But he got away with it. So, and that moment, yeah, whatever you think of VAR, it was hugely dramatic. And for neutrals, incredibly funny. And for those of us who wanted to get our report done on the final whistle and not to sit through extra time, it was great news.
Yeah, I feel like we should start with the goal, go through to Kasper Schmeichel saves, and then get on to Wes Morgan's fever dream. Although I agree with you, and especially the Chelsea fans who filmed themselves celebrating and then realizing truly momentous moment, and perhaps one for VAR to say it has to stay just for those moments. But Barry, Tielemans' goal, what a, just to do that in a FA Cup final, what a wonderful thing for him.
Yeah, it's the stuff schoolboy dreams are made of, I suppose, or used to be made of when. The FA Cup was sort of the pinnacle of the game. Scoring a winner like that is just fantastic. And you wonder if he took that shot 100 times, how many times would it go in? But I suppose he was the man of the match. He deserved that goal. And it was Roy the Rover stuff. I mean, it was unsavable, I think. Kepa dived the right way, didn't get near it. And I think you could have had two or three goalkeepers there and none of them had got near it. They'd just have got in each other's way, probably.
Yes, that's true. And it would have been tactically weird from Thomas Tuchel and probably against the rules, wouldn't it?
Well, if it worked, he'd be hailed as an innovator.
You had those and you had the Kasper Schmeichel saves, which, Flo, were superb as well, weren't they?
Yeah, unbelievable. I think the first one where he kind of has to run across the goal and dive to down to the post to try and to keep it out. It's just unbelievable. I mean, the speed at which he has to run across his own goal to get to that and then just to do it with one sort of light palm, just incredible. And then that second one, Mason Mount's shot, the dip and movement on the ball because he sees it quite late and there's a lot of players standing in front of him. So to see it that late as the ball comes in and still to be able to react and get your hand to it is just unbelievable. It was immense. And yeah, you just felt like with that and the VAR and with everything that Leicester have been through as well, it was just, you know, part of the story and part of the narrative, and they had to win. And I don't really have any connections to Leicester City, but I found the whole thing quite emotional. Like, I had goosebumps during the full time and the trophy ceremony. I just thought it was a really, really nice day all round, and to have fans just like added that extra level to it as well.
I think that's true. I think, Wilson, you know, no one needs to say that football is nothing without fans again, or that fans are really important for the game. But, you know, when you think about that Tielemans strike, to see human beings behind the goal, like jumping up in celebration, really makes a difference.
Yeah, I mean, just the general noise made a difference. That suddenly you remember how a crowd behaves, and that you get little ripples of appreciation that the fake crowd noise will never get right. Or you get sort of the gasps of anticipation as a move develops that you can't possibly get right with a mixing desk. And I thought actually another really moving thing was Abide With Me, which, you know, seemed incredibly apt after 130,000 COVID-related deaths. And you sort of realise that football is a great symbol of communality, of a return to something approaching normality, hopefully. And so, you know, Abide With Me was first sung at a cup final in 1927. And it's been sung at everyone since apart from 1959. And I don't know why it wasn't sung in 1959, but it wasn't. And it must have seemed a really odd choice, I think, when George V asked for it. And he only asked for it because it was Queen Mary's favourite hymn. But, apart from possibly 1946, I can't imagine it's ever felt quite so apt.
Since we're talking about history, Wilson, I presume you or Barry wants to compare those Schmeichel saves to Sunderland-based FA Cup final saves in greatest cup final save.
Not chat. As good, but very good. I mean, Guy Mowbray did it as well. I mean, it's almost like Guy Mowbray used to cover Sunderland on local radio in the Northeast. But yeah, look, nothing will ever be better than Jim Montgomery's save, not just in terms of saves, not just in terms of football, but in the whole of human history. Nothing will be better than Jim Montgomery's save in 1973 FA Cup final. So it's ludicrous to try and compare Schmeichel's saves to that. But they were both great saves. They just weren't Jim Montgomery.
If Kasper Schmeichel had done those two saves within a split second of each other, they still wouldn't have been as good as Jim Montgomery's save.
Correct.
Right. And there's no Sunderland bias there. I mean, Wilson's saying it's the greatest moment in the history of humanity.
I wouldn't say that. I'd say any species.
Oh, right. Okay. Can we talk about the VAR moment? I mean, Kieran says, should fans who film themselves at games on their phones be banned from ever attending a game again? I mean, I sort of think yes, but there is an amazing clip of a guy who clearly has a selfie stick, which is quite the thing to take to football. Not legacy fans, would not support this. But seeing that, and just seeing the moment where the Chelsea fans realise that Chilwell's goal is, well, it's Wes Morgan's own goal. Although some people seem to think it came off Chilwell, but it definitely came off Wes Morgan, right? Didn't it? 100%.
Chilwell ran onto a ball from deep and sort of steered it goalwards. Soyuncu kind of hooked it off the line into Wes Morgan and it ricocheted into the goal. That's my understanding, but...
Hmm.
Well, I very much enjoyed Guy Mowbray refusing to acknowledge that and just not mentioning Wes Morgan at all in the sort of 5-10 minutes that followed. As if he didn't say it was Wes Morgan, we could pretend it was a Chilwell goal.
I mean, I still feel a bit sick for Wes Morgan. I mean, I'm totally with you. It seems a really baffling thing for Brendan Rodgers to do. I mean, he's like, it's beautifully romantic, but tactically it seems really odd, you know?
Well, the really odd thing, I think, is to do it with 10 minutes to go. I mean, do it with 2 minutes to go. I mean, there is precedent, which is if you go back to the 1986 European Cup final.
Wes Morgan was 32 at the time.
Barcelona against Steaua in Seville. And Angel Iordanescu, he just turned 36. He came on with he was brought on with 18 minutes to go, having not played for over a year. A lot of players hadn't realised he was still registered. He was just an assistant coach. And Emerick Yenné brought him on to see them through the last 18 minutes plus extra time because of his calm head and the fact he was, you know, very composed, passer of the ball. I wouldn't necessarily say Wes Morgan is a very cool head and composed passer of the ball. So at that point, the precedent falls down. But in both cases, it worked. And Jordanescu didn't toy with scoring a hilarious own goal. So
I don't know. It's still like Barry and I were saying on the radio, that's his anxiety dream now for the rest of his life, isn't it? He's going to wake up at 4 a.m. going, oh God, I scored an own goal in the cup final. Oh, okay, actually. And then, where am I? It's okay. Glass of water, have a wee, go back to sleep, Wes. Jamie Vardy has played in every round, the only player to play in every round of the FA Cup, I believe, including all the preliminary rounds, 13 of them, and he has now won it. They're making that Hollywood movie, I think they are, at least, or it's taking a are step they? Closer, apparently.
Who is going to watch this movie if it ever gets made? I mean, apart from maybe Jamie Vardy and his family.
I've watched movies about about sports I don't care about.
I feel like it's going to be like that movie that James Corden did about that bloke that won Britain's Got Talent.
Oh no, I don't like the sound of this.
Yeah, it's got that vibe to it.
Oh, that might have been good. Who are we to knock
I've
it?
I've never seen it, but you never
Ted
know.
Ted Lasso, and apparently it's brilliant.
So. I think James Corden as a casting choice for Jamie Vardy would be bold.
I mean, he'd do it. He'd do it. You know he would do it.
Wow. Do we think that it was interesting watching, the owners and obviously what happened with Konvichai, the tragedy that happened there and his son being so loved by the players and the fans and this sort of club that are seemingly all together. And the fact that Leicester weren't in the European Super League plans and Chelsea were. Is it overblown, Flo, to sort of look at this as a sort of a victory for everyone against the evils of football?
I don't think it's overblown because everyone likes a good news story. I think especially at the moment, it's a pretty bleak world. I haven't hung my washing outside since about September last year. It's constantly raining every day and it doesn't seem to be an end to that. So I can understand why people want to look for those moments in everything. And for a lot of fans, the Super League was an example of the worst parts of football and people love this story. And I think a lot of fans are envious, not in a kind of horrible way, but in a sort of, I wish I had this at my club. And the way that everyone was embracing each other, Rodgers and the owners, the players and the owners. And it was actually more about the owner's moment as well, rather than, everyone wanted him to have the trophy and they wanted to watch him lift it and see that emotion. And I just also think what they've done behind the scenes in terms of the local community and the money they donated to the local hospital and all those other things is a great example of a good way to run a football club. And they've also been, very economical and sold players for lots of money. So I think there's just lots of positive examples around them. And I can understand why people want to hear about that and not all the other horrible stuff that's going on.
Well, I think when the Bucks won the Super Bowl, Joel Glazer was presented with the trophy first. I think that's an American football thing. The owner is presented with the trophy. If Manchester United won the FA Cup in front of a full house at Wembley and Joel Glazer had the audacity to go and be presented with the trophy, can you imagine the reception he would get from Manchester United fans?
But I mean, you say the same for the thoughts of Arsenal winning a cup and you're saying, Stan, calm down, or Tottenham, go, Daniel, Joe and Daniel, calm down. We'd love to hug you and celebrate with you.
Well, they clearly are. Yeah, really good owners. They clearly have connected with the local community. They clearly are aware that the club is not just a business. It has a wider function. And they clearly are very popular with the people who work for them. So in that sense, it is a positive story. On the other hand, they are still incredibly rich people from the other side of the world who've come in and bought the club. And that, I think, is it's a little bit of a worry for football that you end up, As a fan of a club, what do you want to happen? Your club can't compete by sustaining itself. It can't generate its own revenues, which is how it ideally probably should be. You're still looking for, I don't know if they're billionaires or if they're just multimillionaires, but you're looking for somebody incredibly rich to come in and buy you, and you're just hoping you get the good one. So it is a hugely positive story in that these are good owners and that they weren't part of the Super League, and that I don't think Leicester ever would be part of the Super League just because of the nature of the club and the size of the stadium and the size of the city. But it's, I'm slightly uncomfortable with seeing it as this sort of great fairy story, romantic tale. And that's just a problem of modern football and modern football financing.
But isn't there something interesting that it doesn't seem too difficult to be good, you know, like how hard is it to be a good owner?
It's not hard at all. The supporters and journalists and everyone else are very easily bought. You know, we get us a pint on the owner's birthday and everyone gets a pint and a pie. Great, I'm sold. You've got me. But it's little gestures, but they mean a lot. And then you look at Tottenham and how teenyered they are and how poor they are reading the room. And I'm singling them out, but there are many other examples. Charging 60 quid for the fans that are allowed to go to a meaningless game against Aston Villa. I mean, that's just pathetic.
Can we have a word on Chelsea? They seemed a little blunt on Saturday, didn't they, Flo?
Yeah, I think from a Chelsea perspective, there was a lot of chat afterwards about Tammy Abraham being left out, and his girlfriend actually as well went on Instagram and kind of called the manager out about that and wasn't best pleased because he's been their top scorer in the competition. And I think there was a maybe frustration around some of the decisions, but then at the same time, you know, VAR is VAR, and on another day they would have got that equaliser, and I think they probably would have won in extra time because they would have had the momentum and they would have, I think, forced something even before it would have gone to penalties. So I think maybe there's a little bit of frustration with some of the decisions, but overall I think, you know, they just wasted the opportunity they had, and Schmeichel put on a clinic.
Sverre says, I have a question for you on the email regarding Tuchel's future at Chelsea. As I understand, he's on a short-term contract. While without a doubt's turned their run, still a risk that Chelsea will not play Champions League football next year. They've got this game against Leicester on Tuesday night. Given Chelsea's loss against Leicester in the cup final, will he get a renewed contract if Chelsea don't get top four or win in Porto? I mean, he's got to, hasn't he, Baz?
You'd think so. I think he's done a tremendous job there, even though they're now in crisis because they've lost two games in a row. But, you know, if he was to lose another final and not finish in the top four, who's to say Roman Abramovich would decide to get rid and hire someone else? He's a hard man to read. If I owned Chelsea, I'd leave him there, whatever happened, for at least another season. But it's very hard to second guess Roman.
It is, yeah. And that game on Tuesday is huge now, given what happened at the Hawthorns and Alisson's header. And we will discuss that in part three. Before we do that, with apologies to Chelsea fans after discussing that cup final defeat, we'll discuss another cup final defeat in Gothenburg in the Women's Champions League in part two. Part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's bring Susie Rack, the Guardian Women's Football correspondent, who is in Gothenburg, onto the pod. Hey, Susie.
Hey, Max, you all right?
Yeah, I'm good. All right then, Barcelona 4, Chelsea 0. Where do you even start? I mean, possibly with the four goals in the first half, I guess, Susie. But it's funny, it's sort of hard to know what the shape of that game was or what the style of that game was, because there were just lots of goals and then it was basically done.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like quite a harsh beginning for Chelsea, in that own goal was just, you know, very, very fluky. And it did sort of feel like all of their luck ran out at once, because they had, you know, benefited from a similarly freaky own goal off the same player, Melanie Leupolz, in the first leg against Bayern, where they grabbed an away goal that came in off her face. So in that sense, it kind of felt a bit like karma. But and then the penalty not long afterwards, I mean, I've watched it again and again, and it's so hard to tell who catches who, that again, you know, you could have seen it given or not given. But I mean, Barcelona, like, there's so many excuses you can make. I mean, the Chelsea's fullbacks are inexperienced and, you know, kind of really got picked apart. But ultimately, I mean, they just kind of lost all over the pitch. It was a terrible performance. But I think they just, that first goal, I thought there was a bit of an air of, we've dealt with bigger problems than this. We can still do something. But that second goal, I think, really sort of sucker punched them and shell shocked them a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, you sound a bit, it was that sense. It felt a bit like, you know, when Spurs conceded that penalty, that sort of daft handball in the Champions League final in the first minute of that game, you just thought, well, this is sort of done. And it had that feeling, I think. And you're right. And I thought, and you obviously watched them much more than I do, but Chelsea didn't have an answer to Caroline Graham Hansen and Lieke Martins at all. And also Barcelona just seemed to win every second ball, wherever it was on the pitch. They looked stronger and fitter.
Yeah, it was kind of a bit deja vu-y for me because I was at the final 2 years ago when Barcelona lost to Lyon in their first final appearance. And that was 4 goals in the first half an hour to put Lyon 4-0 up. And Ada Hegerberg, they scored in the 5th minute, and then Ada Hegerberg scored a 16-minute hat-trick. And it felt eerily familiar. That game finished 4-1 in the end, but like I say, it was over within the first half an hour as well. And it looked like Barcelona really learnt the lesson of that game and pretty much copied the Lyon playbook in coming out really, really fast and strong. And I mean, I suppose the way that you can sort of forgive Chelsea's performance to a certain extent is that they've not been playing together as a team for as long as Barcelona have. You know, this has been the goal for 2 years of Barcelona from that final defeat 2 years ago. This is the thing they've been targeting. And they had a benchmark. They knew what they had to get to. Whereas Chelsea, you know, as much as, you know, in the Super League they've clicked this season, they are still quite a new squad playing together in that, you know, Harder and Loopholes only came in the summer. Sam Kerr only came in last year. So in a sense, they're still as this group at the beginning of their journey rather than the end of it. So I think that, you know, there's positives in that sense in that, you know, it's not like this is the end of this team. But yeah, I mean, I think it's given them a massive, massive benchmark of as to where they've got to get to.
Are the media slightly guilty of overhyping Chelsea? Because being across the coverage of this game in the build-up, I presumed Chelsea were the red-hot favourites. And then I looked at the betting odds and saw that they weren't even remotely favourites. They were, you know, quite the outsiders to win this game. And are, say, you, Flo, and others guilty of bigging up Chelsea more than they deserved? Or was it just a staggeringly bad performance? Because I was thinking, you know, we have all these guys who constantly insult women's football. And if I was one of those guys and I'd gone last night, right, I'm going to watch this game, see what it's all about, I'd have given up after 10 minutes and gone, well, that was shit.
I think it's a bit of both though, Barry, because I think everyone's guilty of it, whether it's men's or women's football, when you're in your little bubble. And obviously in England, we only really see coverage of the Women's Super League domestically, or that's what most people watch. It's quite hard to watch Spanish women's football. You have to find a link online. It's not as easy accessible. And also the commentary is always in Spanish. So a lot of people wouldn't watch it because you lose a lot of that kind of context around it. So I think there's that element too. And I also think it's the same for when you get caught up with an English team. You know, think about England going to major tournaments and everyone has this huge expectation. And then you realize actually they're not as good as everyone else. And I think it's the same thing. You just get caught up in that hype. And I think it's a bit of both, really. I think it's a fact that English media are always going to hype up English teams. That's just kind of, you know, the way it works. But at the same time, also, a lot of people just aren't exposed to how good the rest of the continent is because we don't see a lot of their football, and Barcelona are that good. And I think they've quietly been proving that, but perhaps not on enough of a global stage for it to have kind of broken through to probably English media and American women's football media, where it was much more of a Chelsea dialogue because they've got those big names. And in women's football, those big names kind of is what drives coverage a lot of the time.
Chelsea aren't a bad team. They're a very, very good team. You know, they've won the double. They could still win a treble. And they I think it was the manner of that early stage of the game, the misfortune of that own goal early on, the penalty not long after. Like I say, I think that shell shocked them.
Yeah, it was a moment of shell shock, if anything. And I still think they would have lost if those two goals hadn't would have gone in, but I think we would have maybe seen them get to play football. Whereas last night, it was like they never got that opportunity, because it was such a sucker punch that they just spent the whole time then on the back foot and kind of aimlessly trying to create opportunities out of nothing. And they were just so nervous and shaken by the whole experience. And also that probably comes from dominating an entire domestic season. Now, Barcelona have also dominated their entire domestic season. They haven't lost a game. Chelsea have lost a game. So you could say, well, you know, equally they could have that experience. But Chelsea were by far the most nervous of the two sides. They didn't look confident from the first whistle. I think that has a lot to say about it. Then, whereas Barcelona just looked like they were ready to kind of eat them alive, really. They were so aggressive from the first moment, and Chelsea kind of stood there like, oh shit, what do we do now? So I think it was less about how good they are, like Susie said, and it's more actually managing those big moments and those big games. And Chelsea seemed to lose all of that, even though they have players who have played in fairly big games. Pernille Harder's played in multiple Champions League finals, but somehow that just evaporated within seconds.
Is there any criticism of Emma Hayes? I take the point about the own goal and the penalty obviously changes the dynamic of a game completely. But even between the own goal and the penalty, there was a very good chance that came just from the gap between the centre-back and the full-back being far too big. And so while both full-backs had a really hard night, equally, they in the first half, they were totally unprotected, which strikes me as being a tactical failure, which was then put right in the second half with a switch to the 3-4-3. So is there any sense Emma Hayes could have switched that earlier, or was that problem predictable in a way that it didn't appear to have been predicted?
A bit of both, in that, yes, potentially they... I mean, it's hard to say, isn't it? Like, the attacking might of Barcelona and the way they play is so strong, and Chelsea are woefully short on defenders at the moment of kind of elite quality, in the... I think someone in the press box turned around when Maren Mjelde got injured and said, that's Chelsea losing the Champions League, because of, like, she's such an influential player. So then when you've got Jess Carter and Neve Charles coming into that match, it's always going to be a big ask. But they performed so, so well against Bayern Munich, particularly in the second leg when they both played. The first leg, John Anderson started instead of one of them, and really, really struggled. So they were sort of rewarded for that great performance against Bayern.
But I guess my point is, it's not really an issue of the fullbacks. The fullbacks were left exposed. It's an issue in the midfield rather than the fullbacks. So yeah, okay, they're inexperienced, and it was they're playing against very, very good players. But that's why you need the midfield to be better structured to protect them. And that did happen in the second half.
I think Emma Hayes in some way was probably just guilty of setting up exactly the way she set up pretty much in this competition, regardless of, you know, switching out of a couple of players. She's tried to keep things fairly firm, but Chelsea ended up so, so narrow and just getting overwhelmed on, you know, both sides of the pitch. So, yeah, I think there maybe there was a naivety there, because she thought, well, this is what's has done us so well in the competition so far. Let's not tweak that. But G in the centre of midfield did not have a good game. Sophie Ingle, who is a reliable defensive midfielder who should be able to kind of clean up the mess, felt like she was barely on the pitch last night because she didn't really have much of a role to play. So yeah, you're right. I think maybe there was a little bit of naivety from her to not change things and realise that there were certain areas on the pitch where they were going to need to adapt, otherwise they were going to lose.
Throughout her career, she's been very much, you know, we don't change our game for teams. We play our own way and we do our own thing. And that's what will set us up for victory, essentially. So in that sense, yes, you know, she was at fault in that she stuck to plan. But anyone who saw the team sheet drop would have said that was Chelsea's strongest 11 and strongest formation on the basis of the previous games, in that, yes, the fullbacks were left massively exposed by those further forwards, but in previous games you just hadn't seen that weakness exposed. No team had kind of gone at them in the way that Barcelona did, so there wasn't really a warning that was going to be the case, that they were going to be left so inadequately protected. But yeah, I mean, obviously that, like, the fact that they brought Leupolz off, who has been one of their best players all season, at half time, and yeah, like you say, shifted to 3-4-3, and I thought Guru Raiten did a good job at shoring up one of the flanks. And so in that sense, the fact that she made a change at half time and did shift things, and it did, well, I mean, you could say it shored things up, but the game was already 4-0. Like, Barcelona didn't have to do anything else, so they didn't have to really push it. So whether that did actually change much is another thing. But the fact that she was willing to make changes, I think I give her a bit of credit for that. But I think there was just naivety across the coaching staff as a whole, her included, going into this game. Like, I think they underestimated Barcelona, and I hate to say that about Emma, because she's a, you know, fantastic coach and is very, very good on her prep, but they, you know, they set up for a Bayern or a Wolfsburg, and they're a very, very different team to Barcelona, a Spanish team. But then again they've not played Barcelona. I think they played Barcelona once before, so it was a very, very different test to what they used to.
I think more of the question is going to be now, Max, are we actually just going to see Barcelona dominate the competition? And that will be the biggest thing for Chelsea, is Wolfsburg sort of used to be their biggest Champions League enemy. And once they beat them in the quarterfinal, it was like, it felt like they could go on to win it because they'd overcome that huge hurdle for them in this competition. And it feels like maybe Barcelona is now going to be this enemy for Chelsea for a while, and perhaps is going to be the one team that they're going to keep coming up against. And it's going to take a lot, based on last night, based on the fact that such a huge chunk of Barcelona's team playing the Spanish national team. The Spanish national team is really progressing as well, tipped to win the Euros and do very well next year, which is probably going to break a lot of English hearts. The fact that England are hosting, you know, there's lots of narrative here that all points to a Barcelona kind of dynasty like we've had with Leon, and it being this Chelsea-Barca rivalry for years to come, which is great, I think, for women's football, but not great news, I think, for Emma Hayes, potentially.
The confidence of Barcelona going into this game was incredible. They really believed that they had their hands on that trophy already, and it was you know, quite sort of strange to see. It felt a bit preemptive, but they were just dripping in belief, like, so much so that, you know, when I spoke to Vicky Lissardi, you know, you think, you know, when the draws come out, you know, you'd want to avoid the teams like Lyon and stuff. They were devastated that PSG knocked out Lyon. They wanted to beat Lyon. They wanted to avenge that final before. They believed they could do it. And they went into this whole tournament believing that they were going to win it, and believing they could beat every single team, including the holders who have won it 5 times in a row. And yeah, I mean, that comes from you know, this 2 years of build towards this project. This team have been together, playing together for longer than Chelsea as well, as a group themselves. And I definitely think they can build a massive dynasty, as Flo said.
Susie, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it. Safe trip home from Gothenburg.
Cheers, guys.
We'll be back in just a second to talk about Alison Becker scoring headers in injury time. Part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly. So, Richard Jolly. Alisson averages a goal every 127 games for Liverpool, whereas Jamie Carragher averaged a goal every 184 games for Liverpool. Tim, when was the last time a guy wearing tights scored a winning goal in a football match? Timmy, will Mane be mad with Alisson for not passing to him for the winner? Pete, is that the best-headed goal by an unlikely smouldering bearded hero since Barry's famous header, or did Barry not have a beard in those days? Yes, everyone having the headline Alisson Wonderland. First goalkeeper to score in the Premier League since Asmir Begovic for Stoke in 2013. Wonderful interview with him afterwards, where, you know, he paid tribute to his father, who tragically died early this year. And just, Barry, what a moment, eh?
I couldn't believe it. I was watching, saw him go up for it. Obviously, he wasn't marked. He didn't look at all conspicuous in that penalty area. And it was just a brilliant header. I mean, it was no fluke. It was a perfect skimmed off the top of his head in at the far post. And what a moment in the fifth minute of added time. And a very, very, very important goal for Liverpool.
Wilson, how did you... Wilson, why doesn't anyone mark the goalkeeper? Why did West Brom have a player not... One of their players was not in the penalty area. The whole thing sort of baffling that keepers seem to have this kind of invisibility cloak when they come up for corners.
Well, I presume that it's because teams have quite strictly structured marking plans that... I mean, most teams would mark zonally, I guess. And but the problem is when you introduce an extra player into the box, you probably haven't planned for that. And so that West Brom player, I don't know who it was, who was outside the box, I guess he's got that dilemma. If I go back in, we don't have a chance to score on the break. If I hang around up here, maybe I get to run 70 yards and kick the ball into an empty net. So I guess that's why. And I guess maybe people just don't think goalkeepers are any good at heading the ball. But it turns out, either Alisson's really lucky or he is really good at heading the ball.
It's also strange, Flo, that the ball doesn't seem to go towards the goalkeeper. Like in these moments, the number of times where a goalkeeper not necessarily wins the header, but it's just, I don't know how that is just, not only is there an invisibility cloak, there's like a magnetic force that brings the ball towards the goalkeeper. Unless there are millions of examples of goalkeepers going up for corners and it going nowhere near them, and I've blanked them from my mind.
I think that's true, but also whenever I feel like I see a goalkeeper have a good chance, it's always a bit more scrappy. Like, you know, an outfield player gets the initial contact and then, you know, the goalkeeper nearly has a chance to kind of like tap it in and it's just, whoa, that would have been amazing. But rarely you see an absolute bullet header like that. That's just so glorious. I just kind of Olivier Giroud style, just, oh, it was... magical. But yeah, I think you're right. You don't really remember those moments where actually it's like, I'm the target man and you're aiming for me and it's going to go in. It feels much more chaotic than that normally, whereas this just felt like a perfect corner routine. That why isn't everyone doing this at the end of games?
But surely the reason for that is that if you're sending the keeper up, you're not using him as a decoy. Like the point is to put the ball near him so that his physical bulk will create chaos and something might happen from it. You're not thinking we send the keeper up and that might draw a play to the near post or somebody else can steal in around the back. That's not the point of it.
Just have the keeper on the edge of the box, just if yeah. One drops.
It's a great volley of a ball. Great volley.
Jono says, is a goalkeeper scoring from a corner better than an outfield player going in goal? And has there ever been an instance of an outfield player going in goal and then coming up for a corner and scoring? I think for me, actually, outfield player putting ill-fitting goalie shirt on and gloves is a greater spectacle, even if they don't have a moment like Alisson's yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, I love that. And I think my favourite moment is when Niall Quinn went in goal for Manchester City and saved a penalty from Dean Saunders. That was probably my favourite outfield player in goal moment.
I mean, Niall Quinn had a habit because he did it for Sunderland against Bradford as well. Didn't save a penalty, but I'm pretty sure Sunderland won that game 1-0.
He used to play Gaelic football, so he was quite experienced at that kind of thing.
Not easy to save a penalty from Dean Saunders, is it either? Because, you know, he did strike them. There was some controversy over Liverpool's... I mean, I don't know if we need to talk about any other goal that happened in the Premier League, but like if we trot through them, there's a bit of controversy about Liverpool's first goal in that Mike Dean got in the way of Fabinho, sort of stopped the play, and Liverpool got a free kick. And I don't know if that, you know, on the commentary they were saying that seemed a bit odd. And also, West Brom had a goal disallowed because a West Brom player was in Alisson's eye line, even though the ball didn't go anywhere near that. When West Brom went 2-1 up. And I don't know if both decisions were sort of ultimately...
Well, my understanding is that if the ref gets in the way, it should be a drop ball rather than a free kick. But a lot of stuff happened between the free kick and the ball going in the net.
And the offside was just offside. I mean, if you're standing 3 yards from the goal right in front of a keeper, it doesn't really matter if a ball comes near you. You're clearly affecting the keeper. So I it's one of those that when you first see it, you think, oh, don't rule it out. Then you see the shot from behind the goal and it's sort of like, yeah, okay, you've got to rule that out.
Anyway, a touch of fortune to all of those moments for Liverpool, which means if they win their final two games away to Burnley, home to Palace, they will almost certainly qualify for the Champions League. It would need Chelsea to beat Leicester and then Leicester to really hammer Spurs for Liverpool to not get into the Champions League without winning those games. So they sort of feel like they're in the box seat. And actually, Flo, that, given the season they've had, would be sort of quite impressive, and the number of players that they've had out to sneak in would be quite the success.
Yeah, and I think actually a lot of people had already sort of written them off, and I think they've done quite well to sort of quietly catch up without people really talking about it, and that's probably helped them a little bit, because people had just sort of thought, oh yeah, they're not going to get in those positions, so, you know, let's not bother. And that's probably motivated them a little bit, and other teams perhaps hadn't really been paying attention really. But I think it would be a massive lift for them, because they're probably going to bring in a lot of players in the summer that will stop a season like this happening again.
And can you imagine how bored we'll be of talking about Alisson's header that got them in the Champions League as they prepare for the final in Istanbul next, assuming it is in Istanbul and not move to Portugal again before the final in Istanbul next year. It'll just become one of those moments that everybody talks about and we'll be utterly bored of. So let's enjoy it while we can.
What do we need to happen? Do we need another goalkeeper to score for Leicester or Chelsea? Do we need Mendy or Schmeichel to score so that we don't talk about Alisson? I'm aware that then we would talk about that goal. There's nothing we can do, Wilson, unless you just don't want Liverpool to qualify for that reason.
Liverpool go out tamely in the last 16 to a mediocre French side would work.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see if we can arrange that.
We're pinning all our hopes on Bordeaux.
Speaking of goalkeepers, Stephen says, how patronising did you find Sky and the BBC's treatment of Scott Carson? He's an England international. They talked about him like he was a Make-A-Wish kid.
I mean, he hasn't been an England national for several years.
I mean,
Stanley Matthews was an England national, but I don't think he should be playing on the wing on Saturday.
He started in goal for Manchester City on Friday night, just under a decade since his last Premier League start. That is quite a long time. He also did, because he's quite greying, and I, you know, those in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, but he looks about 48, doesn't he? Like, it really did look like charity
sort of soccer aid thing.
Yeah, it really did. Like he's like a big, he was in Doctors for years and does Panto, and so he's going in goal for the first half and they just keep the ball away from him. He did save a penalty, and I think a bit hot, you know, if you're that old, you know, if you save a penalty, the they shouldn't be able to put in the rebound. I think that should be a law of the game. But Man City won. It was a really fun game. It didn't really mean anything to anybody. Ferran Torres scored a hat-trick. And that volley, I know it seemed like a long time ago now, but that is a thing of utter beauty.
Do you mean the first one where he kind of like hooked it in? That first goal?
Yeah, the back-heel volley. Yeah.
It was amazing. Is that what you want? I mean...
That's what I want.
Yeah, it was a very good... It was a lovely goal. Oh, it was okay. A lovely goal. It was a chaotic game and it was really good fun. So more of that, please.
Could I just give Newcastle a bit of credit for that game? Because we always hear about how Steve Bruce's tactics are turgid and this sitting back trying to attack on the counter. But they actually scored 3 goals using those tactics against the champions. Still managed to lose, of course, but hugely impressive. They could have had 4, but... Because another counter-attack led to a free kick, with which Joe Shelvey hit the crossbar, and that would have put Newcastle 2-0 up. So I thought it was a hugely impressive performance from Newcastle, and for all that, they still managed to lose.
How much of that, you just said, how much of that was motivated by genuine respect for Newcastle, and how much by a desire to wind up Newcastle fans?
Oh, almost entirely desire to wind up Newcastle fans. Who have, you know, are constantly critical of those tactics, but they usually don't work as well as that. And to have them work so well and still lose, that's quite an achievement.
Do you enjoy winding up Newcastle fans, Barry?
Steve Bruce gets all the blame for everything that goes wrong at Newcastle, but gets no credit whatsoever when things go right. And that, I think that's quite unfair. I appreciate he's not the world's greatest manager, but having said that, I think in Rafael Benitez's best season, you know, he was seen as some sort of messiah. He only got one more point than Steve Bruce got last season. And his tactics, you know, they're not exactly Samba-style tactics either. So I think while I understand Newcastle fans would prefer an upgrade on Steve Bruce, I don't think he's as bad as they make out.
Tottenham 2, Wolves 0. Yes, I mean, this game didn't mean a whole lot, but Spurs sort of pushing for Europa League. Dele Alli was wonderful in this game and is a lovely footballer. Whoever finishes seventh, by the way, which might be West Ham at this rate, who drew with Brighton, may qualify for the conference plate, sort of, you know, the third tier trophy, which I was utterly against. But now I've seen how Leonard Slutsky celebrated for Ruben Kazan with a little dance in a video. I am thoroughly now in favour, and I think every manager who qualifies, I think we could make the European Conference, Europa Conference plate, the exact name of the trophy, I'm not sure, more exciting if managers just had to sort of all be like Slutsky for the whole thing.
I think it's a great idea, and I think there should be more things like it. That we complain about a self-perpetuating elite who get loads of money and they play in Europe and so they get more money and that makes them even stronger, so they buy better players and afford higher wages. And so they, yeah, their strength grows and grows and grows and self-perpetuating. One of the ways of tackling that, one of the ways of spreading money through the game and spreading it to countries outside the big three or five leagues in Western Europe is by having more European competitions. Now, it may be that if you're an upper mid-table Premier League side, you find it a bit of a chore to have to go and play in Macedonia or Belarus or wherever. If you don't want it, don't play in it. Let somebody who wants to play in it play in it. And I'm sure there's lots of lower Premier League sides or Championship sides who quite like the trip. And I think we should respect these trophies. I'm not saying we should necessarily cover them in great detail because there's lots of football and maybe this isn't that important. But as a way of beginning a process of redistribution, I think these smaller European competitions are actually really important.
With you and Slutsky between you in different ways, you have changed it.
Leonard Slutsky, one of the very few managers who I have occasional WhatsApp conversations with. He's a great man for the thumbs up emoji.
Is he? Okay. Well,
which I think is his, I sort of agree with you, but I can't bother to talk to you.
I'd like this conversation to end emoji. Leeds won 4-0 at Burnley. Calvin Phillips hit a wonderful pass, which I really thoroughly enjoyed. There were some firsts. Daniel Jebison scoring his first ever goal on his first ever start for Sheffield United in a deliciously Everton-like 1-0 home defeat to the bottom side in the Premier League, which another highlight was on whichever channel Keyes and Gray are on. Richard Keyes thinking a fire alarm was going off, but it was just the start of Zed Cars. what is this? It's like a siren is how it starts.
Yeah. You just thought of all people, Richard Keyes was familiar with kind of very conservative British dramas of the 1950s.
So that was very funny. Palace 3, Villa 2, Southampton 3, Fulham 1. I have nothing to say about those games, but there were some firsts for some people.
Well, Everton's home form, I think, is a bit of an issue. After all the praise we gave them the first couple of months of the season, it's actually been a pretty disappointing, mundane season for them. I think there were 5 home wins all season. Which I think is, it's either their worst or their joint worst home record in the Premier League. So I think, yeah, there's issues there for Ancelotti to look at next season.
Fitbar, we'll get Ewan on soon to do it properly, but Rangers completed their unbeaten season in the league. 32 wins, 6 draws, won all their games at home. 4-0 win over Aberdeen. It's the playoffs tonight, everyone. Bournemouth, Brentford, Barnsley, Swansea. League One sees Oxford Blackpool on Tuesday, Lincoln Sunderland on Wednesday, League Two, Forest Green at Newport on Tuesday, Tranmere Morecambe on Thursday. William says, pod predictions on how exactly Sunderland will blow the playoffs. Wilson's thoughts on Lincoln City before the playoff semi-final, non-league team in 2017 with a chance of the championship in 2021, playing progressive attacking football under Appleton, a coach to watch?
Well, they beat Lincoln pretty comfortably at Central Bank in the league this season, which is always a bad sign. You don't want to have beaten a team playing in the playoffs comfortably. So I think they might squeak by Lincoln and lose in the final. That's the traditional way of doing it. Unless The other option is it goes to a penalty shootout of the stadium alight and Jeff Whitley tries a Panenka, of all the stupid sentences I've ever had to say.
Lincoln is one of those clubs and places I know nothing about, don't know where it is, but...
It's in Lincolnshire.
Well, I don't know where Lincolnshire is.
It's out east.
Producer Sammy could probably tell us. He's really good on counties.
But the worst tattoo I've ever seen on another human being was a Lincoln City tattoo. I was on holidays in Turkey and walked past this guy, and it was actually jaw-droppingly bad tattoo across his chest, Lincoln City FC. And anytime I see or encounter Lincoln or something happens, I'm always drawn back to the memory of crossing paths with this young lad who had this awful, awful tattoo.
What was so bad? So, what was so bad about it? Just the words Lincoln City? Was the font bad? Or?
Well, it wasn't really a font. It was like he'd kind of done it himself, just as if his torso, he divided it into four quarters and okay. Then L, C, F, C. Just no crest, no attempt at jazzing it up with a nice font or anything.
Definitely Lincoln, not Leicester.
Oh, yeah, because he had a Lincoln City jersey over one shoulder. Or, sorry, sticking out of his waistband of his shorts. That's how I knew it was Lincoln City FC.
Lincoln Cathedral was the tallest building in the world for almost 200 years.
Thank you, Wilson.
I went there on holiday in 1985 and spent most of the time trying to watch the Ashes.
Okay. Is it a popular holiday destination for people?
Not with me. No.
There's a really big retail park, actually, right in the town centre. Good few options there.
As previews of football matches go, I don't think you're going to get more incisive one of Lincoln v Sunderland anywhere.
Look, Atleti are probably going to win La Liga. It's down to them and Real Madrid. Juventus could still get into the top four, but they're not in it at the moment. The Turkish Super League was won by one goal, Beşiktaş over Galatasaray. Both finished on 84 points. Galatasaray would have won it if the goal difference had been equal. So quite tight there. Great weekend for Sutton. They beat Maidenhead 3-0 on Saturday. Torquay can only draw at Stockport in the race to win the National League. And let me do a couple of emails. Dan Fell says, I'd like to stake a claim for the most pathetic car crash while listening to the pod. We've heard about people crawling from wreckage or balancing precariously on grassy mounds. My story is the equivalent of Ben Fisher's car park anecdote. I once crashed into half a lamppost at around 2 miles an hour after leaving my local barbershop. I got in the car and the opening music of the pod hadn't even finished before the crash had already taken place. I can't blame any one of you, but more my terrible driving, lack of awareness, and the distraction of my new haircut. There are more of us out there. Hamish says, not a car crash, but I was listening to the pod while working from home and I was emptying the dishwasher when I accidentally stabbed myself with a fork. So we'll take any more of those home injuries, and that'll do for today's pod. Thank you very much, Flo.
Cheers, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Cheers, thank you.
We'll be back on Wednesday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.